The king was holding his face and sobbing.
"You killed Rohit," he said
when he saw the headless body in the hall.
"I made Rohit my Ashok because every prophet needs a servant to strike fear into the hearts of the wicked. With no Ashok, they wouldn't respect me like they respected her."
Devadas sheathed his sword and grabbed hold of Pankaj's hand. Then he took up the pinky finger and snapped it. "Where is Ashok?" Then he broke the next. The king screamed. His concubines screamed. "Where is Ashok?" He broke the next. And the next.
"Where?"
"They left,"
he managed to get out through the sobbing.
"To the mountains, to the west."
Devadas had just come from that region after a futile search. He might have even passed them on the way.
"When?"
"I don't know. What day is it?"
Devadas snapped his thumb.
"They left the next morning."
"A month ago."
A cold rage descended upon Devadas.
"They took the hostages, and half my faithful betrayed me and went with them,"
Pankaj wailed.
"Couldn't they see I was the one Mother Dawn chose to save the city? The gods will smite you for this."
"I've heard that threat many times, but have yet to meet one of these supposed gods. They must be afraid. I'd love for them to come out and fight." Protector Jamari rushed back into the bedroom.
"Building secure, sir. No sign of Ashok."
"This imbecile says they went to the mountains a month ago. Question the other survivors and see if you can confirm that. I want numbers, direction, and any possible clues to their destination." Jamari left. Then he turned back to Pankaj. "Where in the mountains did they go?"
"I don't know. Some secret hideout the Keeper of Names found years ago. It was once the Hall of the Marutas, the Storm Gods. Runaways built a whole town inside, but only the Keeper knows the secret way in."
As long as Ashok lived, his order would be shamed. As long as Ashok lived, Umand would keep the crown from him. As long as Ashok lived, Radha would have to remain in hiding. As long as Ashok lived, Devadas's destiny would go unfilled. As long as Ashok lived. He had just missed him by 29 days. Devadas let go of the hand. Pankaj held the ruined thing to his chest and cried,
"You can't do this to me. I'm a king."
"You're no king." Devadas drew his sword. "Lok will know a real king soon enough." He slashed Pankaj across the belly and dumped his guts on the rug. Chapter 21.
"Here we are. This is the entrance," said Thera.
She had never told Ashok how to get to Keeta's hideout, and Ashok had never asked. His obligation was to her, not these criminals, so there was no point in knowing how to get inside without her. Yet as Ashok looked around, he could see absolutely nothing that looked like an entrance to a secret rebel kingdom, or, frankly, anything else of interest at all. And that made him a little curious. From the way Keeta had talked the place up, it was like he had a hidden fortress full of industrious people, free of the law, toiling happily together beneath the smile of a benevolent god. All Ashok saw was rocks. Lots of rocks. Though rocks were still a welcome change from the seemingly endless plains. For weeks, their lumbering column had crossed the grasslands. For the last few days, they had been following a stream of freezing cold runoff through the foothills and up into the mountain valleys. This particular valley appeared to be a dead end. Before them was a narrow lake, surrounded by pine trees. On the other three sides of the lake were rocky cliffs. Beyond those abrupt walls stretched the extremely steep, snow-capped mountains of western Akashan.
Where?
Ashok asked. Right here. You'll see. Ashok sharpened his vision, but even his heightened senses could discern no path up the cliffs. Calling upon the heart, he might be able to scale them, but the others would be trapped.
What do we do now?
We wait for Keita to open the door for us. Thera turned her mount and began walking back toward their column. Horus flicked one white ear, annoyed.
Ashok patted his neck.
I hear you, boy.
Thera's army, now numbering nearly 800 men, women, and children, was waiting in the valley below them. They were mostly castless who had fled from the warrior's purge, but there were also a surprising number of workers and even some warriors who had been among the faithful in Chakma. They'd brought along their livestock, seed, and their most valuable tools. All that cargo meant that they had made terrible time. The only reason they had not run out of food was that Ongud had known about every warrior supply cache in the region, and he'd sent the sons out to loot them all. Ashok drew alongside her.
Does Keita really have room to house all these people?
He does. It's actually rather impressive.
And somehow feed them all?
For the thousandth time, yes, Ashok. I've not just led them all up into the mountains to die of exposure. I don't expect them to eat pine needles or turn to cannibalism. I'm no idiot.
True. You are not.
Thank you, silver-tongued Ashok, master of compliments. Just trust me.
I am obligated to do so.
Thera laughed. Admit it. By now you would trust me anyway. He gave her a grudging nod. She was correct. However, if I've drastically overestimated Keita's abilities, there is that vast herd of cows being driven along a day behind us to obliterate our trail. We could eat them.
While faithful to your silly gods, I do not think those drovers would appreciate you depriving them of their livelihood.
Ashok knew that the lesser castes did not enjoy having their property confiscated. That had never mattered to him as a protector, but it did now. I'd make it fair. We could always trade them some demon parts for their herd. We've got piles of the stuff and no wizards to use it.
What would cow herders do with magic? He asked suspiciously. It is illegal to sell or possess without a license.
Oh, Ashok, it's endearing how you still honestly think anyone out here cares about the law.
And I think you underestimate how much regular people fear attracting the attention of someone like...
Ashok caught himself. He'd been about to say, me.
A protector.
The two of them rode along in silence the rest of the way down. It was a warm day. The sky was clear and blue. In Thera's company, it was almost pleasant. They had formed an odd relationship. He was her guard, her enforcer, and now her lover. But it also became something more than that. This feeling of partnership was an unfamiliar thing, and not one that Ashok had ever before experienced in his life. He did not mind it, but Ashok was unused to such thoughts, and was happy to return to his duties. Duty, even an illegal one, was easy to understand. You're much better at being loud. I need their attention, Thera told him as they stopped on a small rise overlooking the column. Ashok raised his voice.
Your prophet speaks!
Everyone stopped what they were doing and looked his way.
Heed her words and relay them down the line.
Thera stood up in her stirrups to be a bit taller. In the preceding weeks, she had gotten quite a bit more comfortable with her role as a figurehead, so she spoke with confidence. Even Ashok could not tell if this confidence was real or feigned. She had given these people no signs beyond keeping them alive, yet they followed. The voice had not come upon her since the graveyard, but truthfully, Ashok thought she was better off without its meddling.
Our long journey is almost done. In a few hours, we will be able to enter the Creator's Cove. There we can be safe. There's only one small part left, only a few miles, but it will be different. Right away, I need everyone to fill all their canteens and water the animals. Then I need you to find dry wood to make torches.
That, too, was curious. Thus far, they had not marched at night, and it was only lunchtime. They still had quite a bit of daylight remaining. Perhaps they were going underground. There were many caves in Locke. Since they were a popular place for smugglers or criminals to hide, he had been inside several cave systems over the years. Only Ashok could not imagine there being one big enough for the population of a town to live in, and even if there was a cavern so gigantic, surely the residents therein would become sickly without the sun.
One torch for every five or six of you should do. Now come on, get to it,
Thera ordered. A month ago, they would have milled about stupidly. A few would have even argued with her, or murmured about being forced to labour. Now they simply hopped to and did as she said. There'd been no miracles on the plains, but Thera had been a consistently good leader the whole time, addressing their problems while keeping them moving, motivated, and fed. "I think Keita would be pleased with how you have done," Ashok told her.
"He'd better," she said smugly.
She clicked her tongue, and her horse began descending the rise.
"I'm not too ashamed of this bunch myself."
Ashok had to admit that they had accomplished far more than he'd expected. Taking Chakma and then leaving it in Pankaj's prideful hands had caused a far greater distraction than anything he would have been able to accomplish by himself. His scouts reported that every warrior they came across had been heading toward Chakma or hunkering down to protect their home garrisons from attack. The order of casteless extermination was so neglected, it might as well be forgotten. As for the casteless, most were staying in place, hoping that this threat would pass, but many others were fleeing the region. Apparently, it was only in the northern provinces of Great House Akashan that they'd been ordered killed. What would happen to the castless in the future, he did not know, but for now, they were still alive because Thera had directed him to take action. The slaves came to take their horses and left them with some freshly cooked rabbit on a skewer. Thera had declared the silent people to be free, but since they were still doing the exact same things for them that they'd done for the House of Assassins, Ashok had a hard time thinking of them as anything other than slaves. If the magical pattern that had broken their minds was weakening, the process had been too gradual for him to notice. They sat together on a fallen tree.
"Meat on a stick while sitting on a log. I do miss my glorious command tent."
Thera had abandoned the ostentatious thing on the third day of their journey. It simply took too long to set up and take down, and required several animals to lug it about. She had kept a few of the pillows, though.
While he and Thera ate, a shout went up at the back of the column. "Riders, incoming!"
Ashok had left a string of spotters trailing behind them to relay warnings of danger. He tensed, but then relaxed when he heard some shout that Toramana's expedition had caught up with them. Thera couldn't sharpen her hearing like he could, so she looked to Ashok.
"What is it?"
"The wild men have returned."
"Excellent. I can't wait to hear how our diplomatic mission went."
"You sent the barbarian chief of a gang of lawless swamp dwellers to deliver prisoners and an ultimatum to the most delicate members of the first caste. It was doubtlessly the least diplomatic thing imaginable."
"Don't underestimate Toramana, Ashok. Keeping his people alive beneath the wizard's shadow made him rather cunning. I told him to try and look like a frightening savage. I'm certain he delivered."
"Do you think all his men pay to their heads to look like skulls again?"
"I certainly hope so."
A short while later, the returning wild men were greeted with great enthusiasm as they made their way up the stretched-out column. From the smiles on their faces, their mission had been a successful one. Sure enough, they had covered their faces with white ash and black charcoal around their eyes to create pits and lines across their mouths to create the illusion of fangs. War face, they called it. Ashok found the habit odd. Personally, he had never needed to try and look intimidating. He was intimidating simply by existing. But then again, these were the same odd people who thought burning eerie sin dolls made for a fine celebration. The contingent of wild men rode toward Thera, proud in their furs and feathers, waving to their wives and children and all the adoring refugees. They were popular among the camp, because to the faithful, the wild men were the ones who had saved the voice from the wizards and dug the Forgotten's warrior out of the rubble. To the not-so-faithful, they were a fearsome bunch of archers who could be nearly invisible when they put their minds to it. The wild men were still awkward horsemen, but they had improved greatly over the last month. They had, after all, gotten a seemingly endless amount of practice.
"Greetings, Chief Toramana."
"Hail, Prophet!"
Toramana dismounted, almost graceful now, for such a large man who seemed chiseled from a brick of muscle.
"I hope all is well."
"Better than well. You caught up to us right as we were about to enter the cove."
"Then the gods have smiled upon us,"
Toramana shouted. His men made the repetitive deep bark that they used as a cheer. The fanatic seemed to love that. Ashok was uncertain just how much Toramana actually believed in the gods and how much of his loyalty to Thera was based on pragmatism, but he was nonetheless an effective leader dedicated to making a better life for his people. Hopefully Keita's secret kingdom would live up to their dreams.
"It was slow getting there, but swift as the wind to return to you. The gods blessed us with good timing. But it was the voice who had the wisdom to send us with a guide who kept us from getting lost on those awful featureless plains."
Ongud Kedekar Dar Akashan approached.
"It's only confusing if you're not from here."
The young warrior had left behind his uniform and had dressed to blend in with the swamp people, though he'd not bothered to smear ash on his round face. There was only so much indignity a civilized man would bear.
"There's plenty of landmarks when you know what you're looking for."
"Grass, grass and more grass," Toramana said. "Occasionally, a stick."
"It beats Swamper's directions like turn left at the alligator,"
Ongud responded.
"Ha! Accurate."
The chief slapped the much shorter warrior on the back, nearly knocking him over.
"How far did you fare in Kochar's Pass?" Thera asked.
"We delivered all the hostages, warrior and highborn both, alive and mostly in one piece. The perfumed sissies living there didn't seem to know what to do with all of them."
The location had been Ongud's suggestion. The palace at Kochar's Pass only had a tiny garrison stationed there. It was best known for its artisanal school, renowned for the sweeping vistas where the first caste could practice their painting and be inspired to write bad poetry, and not much else. It had also not been too far out of their way.
"I made your ultimatum clear. These lives were a gift to the Akashani chief, a showing of respect. We let these warriors live so that he would be moved to let the casteless live. I said our prophet only wants to be left alone. There was no need to hunt for us because they would never see or hear from us again. Unless they came again against the castless, because then Ashok Vadal would return to kill more of his men and capture more of his towns."
"How did they take that?"
Toramana gave her a sly grin.
"The ones I told this to were feeble, girlish men who stank like they rolled in flowers. Their perfume made my nose itch. I think they were very frightened of me. But better to remember it that way. Their chief will get the message."
"And you were not followed?"
Ashok asked.
"We're clear, General," Ongud replied. "I'm certain of it. The swampers got a little exuberant."
We stole all that garrison's horses, Toramana explained. But do not worry. There was a village a day's walk from the pass. In the wrong direction. But we'd already made the prisoners walk so far already. What's another day?
Fantastic work, all of you, Thera said. Now, go see your families and get some food in your bellies. We should be moving out in a couple of hours.
There's one other thing, Ongood said. On the way to the pass, we encountered some merchants fleeing south. They said the warriors had laid siege to Chakma, but when the protectors got there, they just climbed the walls and ripped the place apart. The protectors executed many men.
For a moment, Thera looked stricken. The news wasn't surprising, but Ashok knew she had felt guilty about how things there had turned out there.
Pankaj's pride killed them, not you.
She sighed.
I tried to warn them. Only if they'd not been there like a big defiant beacon drawing every warrior in the country, then we might not have made it this far unseen.
Toramana grinned.
I like to think just as Mother Dawn picked my people for our courage and skill, she picked that tax collector precisely because he had such a swollen head. Perhaps this was her plan all along. She is plainly a divine being sent by the gods, able to see into the future. We should be thankful that she has been preparing the way.
That sounds absurd, Ashok said.
Yet she appeared in my swamp and told my people to expect you,
Toramana replied as he spread his hands apologetically.
Long before you ever thought of travelling to the Bajangal, as you said yourself.
And she told mine when to be on the road to Haradas so we could join you, said Ongood. But regardless of what the mother really is, the merchant said all the rebels and suspected collaborators in Chakma were put to the sword by a protector with a big scar on his face.
Devadas, Ashok muttered. This is dire news.
You know him? Thera asked.
The Lord Protector of the Order, who was once my brother. I am the one who gave him that scar.
There's a story there, I'm sure,
Toramana said.
There is, though I will not tell it.
But this Devadas won't find us now, Thera said. We're a long way from Chakma.
Distance does not matter. Underestimating him is a fatal mistake. Devadas is perhaps the most dangerous man in the world.
Thera was incredulous at that claim. Even more than you?
What I accomplished with an ancestor blade, he did nearly the equivalent by strength of will alone.
Ashok's ever truthful nature was now well known to all, so Toramana and Ongood shared a nervous glance. There were many fearsome combatants among the Sons, and Ashok rarely gave praise. For him to speak so highly of an enemy...
How long ago did the Protectors take the city?
6 days, General.
Protectors would move with far more swiftness than this cumbersome mob. Ashok looked to Thera.
Then if you have a way to make Keeta open the door faster, I suggest you do so.
Don't worry.
She pointed toward the nearby stream. It took Ashok a moment to realize that the water level had dropped nearly a foot while they'd been standing here.
It's already started.
Chapter 22. The small mountain lake was now less than half its original size. By what mechanism the flow into the lake had been stopped, Ashok could not tell. The remaining water was waist-deep and clear enough that the rocky bottom could be seen all the way across. They wouldn't even have to worry about demons. Not that there should be any this far into the interior anyway, but with the creatures of hell, you never knew. Havildar Eklavya was standing nearby and had been studying the situation for quite some time. Jagdish had said the clever young warrior had a mind for fortifications. Apparently, his love of engineering extended to drainage systems as well, because he seemed rather fascinated by it all. He'd been tossing sticks into the water to watch where the current took them.
See that shadow beneath the water back there? Eclavia said to the other sons. A banknote says that's the secret entrance.
Nobody took Eclavia up on his bed.
I'm guessing there's a reservoir above us somewhere, and it was draining downhill enough to keep this lake full. They shut it off somehow. The entrance to the Keeper's secret kingdom will be revealed soon.
Ashok would have asked Thera if Eclavia's theory was correct, but she was busy using the time to give instructions, riding her horse back and forth among the shoreline as her people crowded close to hear.
We'll have to lead the animals. It's dark in there, so don't spook them. The water should only be about ankle deep, but there are a few lower spots where you'll have to carry your little ones. It's not that far. Don't be afraid. It's safe.
Are we going to live under the ground?
Asked a castless child.
I don't want to live in the dark.
Don't worry.
We're only passing through the mountain to what's on the other side. We're not going to stay under it for very long.
What if it falls and smashes us flat?
Cried a woman.
The tunnel's not going to fall on us, Thera assured her anxious mob.
Gupta was one of the sons of the Black Sword who had once been a miner in Jarlang.
With tunnels you never know.
But thankfully he kept his voice low so only the other sons around him heard. They laughed nervously, but warriors weren't about to show apprehension in front of these people.
Only Thera overheard Gupta, and she asked him, Have any of your mole holes in Jarlang lasted 1,000 years?
No, Prophet, I don't think so.
He looked down, embarrassed.
Sorry.
Then this is a bit better. They knew how to build things back in those days.
Thera went back to the adoring crowd.
As I was saying, there's no need to fear. I was nervous the first time I came here too. While we wait for the water to go down, I'll tell you the story of this place. As it was told to me by Ratul, who was the keeper of names before Keeta. It was Ratul who discovered this secret path. Like our general Ashok, he had also once been a protector of the law.
Many of the fanatics grimaced or spit when Thera mentioned his old order.
That annoyed Ashok to no end. Even though he was nominally on their side now, and the order's primary goal was his death, it remained a struggle to see such flagrant disrespect for something he'd devoted most of his life to.
Ratul did a great many terrible things, hunting down the faithful or anyone who didn't follow the cruel and often senseless commands of the law. But he learned the truth, that the gods still lived, and so he began to prepare for this day in secret. Ratul always did what was necessary, no matter the danger. Once, I was thrown into the ocean by a wicked man, and I was about to be eaten by a demon, but Ratul dove into the ocean to save me. He fought the demon and scared it away.
Her audience gasped.
That's right. Ratul was very courageous.
And possibly insane, Ashok thought.
He knew that our uprising would need a place to be safe, beyond the reach of the law.
Like fortress,
shouted one of the workers helpfully.
Sort of. But those on the frozen island are no friends of ours.
Not really. They'll sell us powder and weapons, but in their own way, they're just as stuck up as the law.
The Keeper knew we'd need our own land for the faithful to build homes and grow crops. Ratul learned of this place from one of the forbidden books in the capital library, so he went looking for it.
It's older than the law, older than the kings. It was here before the demons fell from the sky even.
The people seemed confused. Since the law had done such an excellent job erasing and rewriting their history, most of the people had no idea what Thera was talking about beyond vague associations with their illegal stories that had been passed down in secret. To most law-abiding people, Lok was as it always had been, and if you wanted to know about what came before, you needed permission from a few specific orders to learn about it. The secret fanatics may have had long memories, but they were blurry ones.
Look,
I'm really bad at explaining all this, but Keita's really good at it, and you will be able to speak to him soon enough. Just bear with me a little longer, and he can explain it to you. Once Ritul got close, he said that he could feel this place calling to him, almost as if it was singing. We have to pass beneath this mountain, but on the other side is the cove, and it's a fine place to make a home.
What if we don't want to go down there?
Someone in the back of the crowd shouted.
Ashok already knew the answer to that.
Thera was hard-headed, but she was also kind-hearted, though she did her best to hide that aspect beneath a mask of sardonic pessimism. If someone really wanted to leave, she would try to talk them out of it, but would ultimately let them go. As for Ashok, most of Locke called him the Black Heart, and that name hadn't been earned because of his mercy or patience. He would always do what needed to be done. With Devadas on their trail, they could not afford to let anyone who knew of this place to be captured. To do so would be to utterly fail in his obligation. Ashok caught Sheker's eye.
"Bring up the rear," he whispered.
Sheker nodded in understanding. All of the sons had differing beliefs as to the true nature of the Forgotten. The Somsak's version was merciless, direct, and practical enough that he would have no issues with removing liabilities. Sheker would keep an eye on that complainer.
"You're committed," Thera said. "There's no going back. The law knows about all of you now. The protectors of Chakma and Dakantar. Anyone they even vaguely suspect of believing in the old ways has already been killed."
"The law knows your name," Ashok warned. "The law does not forget."
"Thank you, Ashok."
Thera turned back to the murmurers.
"Look, I understand you're afraid. But the cove is a rich and bounteous place, where there are no castes determining how you can live, where the faithful are free to worship openly, where the gods have given us resources beyond our dreams. There's plenty of room. There will be a roof over your head. There's wood to burn and grass for your animals to eat. The water's clean to drink. Keita called the place the gods' holy mountain."
Even though Ashok knew Thera did not believe very much of Keita's nonsense, she was doing a good job selling it here. Either she was starting to believe her own propaganda, or she'd overheard Ashok's orders and didn't want the Somsak to have to murder any stragglers.
"All right, we have faith in you, voice,"
the man who had been worried called out.
"We'll follow you through the dark."
Sheker looked slightly disappointed at that change of heart. But they'd be on the lookout for deserters anyway.
"Thank you."
Thera glanced toward the receding water.
"It's almost time. I'll lead the way."
The prophet got off her horse and passed the reins to one of the assassin slaves. Murugan had lit a torch for her and handed it over. It was just a stick with a head of tightly wrapped dead moss, but she'd said they'd not need to last long. Thera took the torch and held it high.
"Follow me."
There was probably some imagery there intended to boost the faithful, but Ashok had no mind for such things. On that note, he didn't like how some of the fanatics had started wearing little metal hooks as jewellery, as a reminder of when he'd come back to life and lifted himself from Sikasa's meat hook. Ashok placed himself at Thera's side. Even though she declared the journey to be a safe one, that did not make it so. Foul creatures lurked in the dark corners of Locke, and who knew what manner of beast might have moved in here since Thera's last visit?
"I need to be in front," she whispered at him. "It's symbolic."
"Of course."
But he stayed close enough that if she fell, he could catch her. Water crept in through the holes of his worn, thin boots as they waded across the lake. It was surprisingly warmer than expected. Runoff from the melting snow would have been shockingly cold,
but the almost comfortable temperature suggested that whatever was feeding this lake from above was volcanic in origin. It was common for hot water to seep from the ground in Dev, but not so much here. It still made him uneasy, though, because no matter what Keita proclaimed to the contrary, Ashok knew that whenever water collected into large bodies, it became a potential source of evil. Water was necessary to support life, cleanliness, and commerce, but it was still made from the same stuff as hell. The tunnel into the mountain was clearly visible. It was bigger than Ashok had expected, being a good 12 feet across and probably 10 feet tall, leaving plenty of room to spare even for their wagons. The rectangular shape marked it as clearly man-made. The material appeared to be rock, but it was so coated in slimy plant life it was impossible to tell. The temperature dropped significantly as they left the sun behind. Having been recently filled, fat droplets of water rained from the ceiling. The ones that hit the torches disappeared with a hiss. The column trudged along obediently after them. Some of the livestock balked at being led into the water, but the silent slaves were remarkably skilled at animal handling and got them soothed without so much as a word. They went deeper and deeper into the tunnel. A slick green ooze had grown on every surface. The water was now up to their knees. If Thera was worried, she didn't let it show. Ashok looked back and could see a line of torches stretching back to the shrinking rectangle of daylight. The fanatics were worried, and it was plain on their faces. Even some of the sons were unable to hide their emotions.
"This is a strange place," Murugan said. "It's unnatural."
"It's a fascinating construction," Eklavia disagreed. "The engineer behind this had to be rather impressive. There's got to be some manner of device up ahead to divert the water, and from the volume necessary, it must be gigantic."
"What happens if they open it back up while we're stuck in here?" Murugan asked.
"That would be interesting."
"Keita's not going to do that," Thera said.
"Assuming Keita's the one in control," Murugan muttered.
"If this place has fallen to the Inquisition, it would be a simple way to drown hundreds of rebels at a time."
"Calm down, boys. I've seen what happens when they turn it back on. It's not a rushing wall of water. It takes hours for the lake to fill back up. Worst case, we'd make a slightly damper retreat. Keita's got lookouts all over the peaks above. They saw us as soon as we entered the valley. Once they decided we were friends, they shut the valve. It doesn't make for convenient travel in and out, but it's secure."
"What if the valve breaks off?" Murugan asked.
"Considering the size of the reservoir above us, if it all let go at once..." Thera thought that over. "Our bodies would probably get washed clear back to Chakma." It was a much different setting than where the heart of the mountain was hidden, but Ashok had no doubt this place had been built in the same era. Ashok knew almost nothing about the time before demons, but the people who had lived back then had certainly liked to build things. In his travels across Lok, he had come across the remains of many great and mysterious structures. These discoveries were often of interest to the capital. In order of descending importance, any images or icons deemed to be religious in nature were destroyed by the Inquisition. Anything relating to stars or constellations went to the astronomers. Artifacts would go to the historians or to the Order of Technology and Innovation. Anything with writing became property of the library. If there was a device with writing on it, well... He had actually seen historians and archivists take offense and get into duels over which order claimed what. Fortunately, those duels had been mostly barehanded and ineffectual, since neither of those orders could fight worth a damn,
and usually ended up with one first-caste man getting a black eye, while the other order got a new treasure to hide in their vaults. It was unclear how far they had gone, but the sun behind them had vanished. Once their way was lit only by torchlight, the fanatics became somber. The moist walls seemed to absorb sound. Even the chickens and goats were quiet.
"Is this the only way in?" Ashok asked.
"If there's others, we've not discovered them yet. Maybe someone like you could climb over the mountains, or a wizard could change into a bird and fly out. But for normal people, this is it. Once inside, leaving is a big enough of a production, you'd better have a good reason for going out. The lake stays warm enough not to freeze, so you can even get in during the worst part of winter. The keeper has a group of rebels he trusts, and he'll send them out a bunch at a time on various errands, but most folks are happy to stay inside. You'll see why, soon enough."
Ashok had to grudgingly approve. It was no wonder his brothers hadn't been able to find the rebels' hideout.
If this place was submerged, how did Ratul find it?
"He swam all the way up this tunnel." Ashok shuddered. His old swordmaster was full of surprises.
Thera looked at Ashok conspiratorially.
"I didn't tell everybody, but in those ancient books where Ratul learned about this place, they declared this place to be cursed or haunted. Probably both. That's one reason it stayed empty for so long."
"Foolishness."
Though he had himself spoken to entities that some would refer to as ghosts, and his sword had been imbued with the memories and emotions of all its previous long-dead bearers, he had been thought that there was no such thing as a haunting, because if there was, that would mean there was some manner of existence after death. And the law did not allow for that. Now, curses, on the other hand, were very much real. All that required was an illegal wizard, some demon parts, and a grudge. But he'd never heard of one strong enough to linger for centuries. They reached a point where the water was almost entirely gone, so each of their footfalls only made a little splash. There was enough airflow that the tunnel didn't become choked with smoke. For the most part, the floor beneath them was level, but there were a few holes. Hopefully none of their cows would break a leg. As their feeble torches began to die off, the tunnel became darker. Each time a torch was extinguished, cries or curses could be heard.
"We're almost there," Thera shouted.
Ashok was unsure if she believed that or was merely trying to comfort them. There was no way to actually tell where they were by the featureless walls. The distance was uncertain. But if Ratul swam this far, there was no way he could have held his breath that long. He must have used the heart of the mountain to keep him alive. Ashok had figured out that same trick fighting Chatterak in the river Nansaka. That experience had been awful, but brief. He could not imagine sustaining it long enough to make it through this tunnel, especially not knowing what would be on the other side. Ratul had been as dedicated in his religious fanaticism as he had been to his swordsmanship. After a time, Ashok's heightened senses felt a change in the air pressure, and his improved vision saw a faint light far away.
"I believe that is the sun."
"Told you we're almost there."
Thera turned back and shouted,
"You hear that, everyone? Ashok sees the sun!"
"I should run ahead and make sure it's safe."
"No, Ashok. These people have been through a terrible upheaval. I need to be the one to lead them into the promised land. I didn't want this stupid job, but it's mine now. They've still got challenges to face. They need something to believe in."
"Getting others to believe in you when you didn't even believe in yourself?"
Ashok found that curious.
"It will do your followers no good if their voice walks into an Inquisition ambush. You have your obligation to them." He nodded back down the tunnel. "My obligation is to you. Let me keep it.
Fine. Just don't make a big deal out of it.
He addressed Murrigan and Eclavia. Stay by her side. Then Ashok called upon the heart to give him speed. To those behind them, it was as if he disappeared from the circle of torchlight in the blink of an eye. He ran the last mile of featureless tunnel in a few minutes. Imagining covering this distance while submerged made him feel a grudging new respect for his old swordmaster. He had loved Ratul once, like the harsh replacement for the father he could not remember. But he had lost that love when Ratul had betrayed their order. Now that Ashok was the despised traitor, he could understand his predecessor a bit better. Ratul had also been gifted with the ability to sense magic. What was it he had felt on the other side of this tunnel that had caused him to risk his life in the darkness beneath? Ashok slowed as he neared the exit and listened carefully. There were people waiting just out of sight. From the sounds of leather creaking and metal clanking, they were armed. If this place had been found by the Inquisitors, better to face them directly and get it over with. Ashok walked into the light. He squinted and held up one hand to block the sun. The tunnel opened into a now empty lake bed. The entire area had been hewn from stone and then rounded by time. On the side opposite the tunnel was a vast grey wall, in the middle of which was a metal square big as an elephant. That must have been the valve Thera had spoken of. When it was lifted, this basin would fill and flood the tunnel. There were also several men waiting in the lake bed with sword, hammer, or spear. But they looked to be lawbreakers, not lawkeepers. Ashok looked up and saw that there were men and women atop the wall with bows and what were probably fortress poles. He looked behind him and saw that rocks had been stacked above the tunnel, the avalanche being held back with only a wooden fence. It would be relatively easy for the rebels to hold this narrow position and bury it if they needed to fall back.
"What's the password?" one of them demanded.
Thera had not told him of such a thing. She had left this place a long time ago, though.
"My password is, lower those weapons before you annoy me. Tell Keita that Ashok Vadal has arrived."
There was a happy laugh from above.
"I knew it! I knew it! Praise the Forgotten! I knew you would come!"
Ashok was not given to frivolity, but hearing that familiar voice caused a faint smile to cross his lips.
"Hello, Keeper."
"Do as he says and put down your arms, my children."
There was a path that led upward out of the lake bed, and a short, balding man came running down the bank with near giddy excitement.
"Before you stands the one I've been telling you about, the Forgotten's chosen warrior himself. Ashok Vadal is here."
"I am."
"I knew you would live."
Keita reached him, and surprisingly enough, grabbed Ashok by the arms and shook him, as if to make sure he was not an illusion. Ashok just stood there, awkwardly. The last time he had seen the Keeper of Names, they had drank together as friends, but that did not mean Ashok was good at such business.
"It is good to see you again, Keita."
"Did you find Thera?"
"She's right behind me."
Keita was so filled with joy, it appeared he might start to cry, but thankfully he let go of Ashok's arms.
"Of course you have her, because you declared you'd walk out into the ocean if you couldn't save her, and Ashok Vadal is a man of his word. I knew she was still alive, and I knew you'd bring her back to the faithful."
He turned back to his people.
"Rejoice, everyone, for the voice has been returned to us at last. All will be well."
The rebels seemed overjoyed at the news.
"Hurry, Ashok. Come with me before she gets here. You need to see this. You need to know what you've been fighting for this last year."
He had been fighting because he had been ordered to protect a criminal, nothing more. But Keita seemed very excited and proud to show off what he had built, so he followed the keeper up the hill.
Behold, the Creator's Cove.
Only a fool named a place something related to the sea, but as he reached the top and looked inside, Ashok actually felt surprise, for it was not at all what he had expected.
At first, Ashok thought the thing stretching before them was a regular mountain valley, surrounded on all sides by giant forested peaks, though the valley was uncannily round.
They were standing at the edge of a circle that stretched for several miles, almost as if a great scoop had come down from the heavens and cleaved a hole in the rocks. To each side, entire buildings had been carved from the walls. Blocky, with circular windows, they were gigantic, and surely the work of the ancients. And with a shock, Ashok realized that there were dozens, maybe hundreds of the structures stretching all the way around the circle's rim. Many of them were crumbling, but most seemed solid.
What was this place?
The people who came before built it for us as a gift, and now we have claimed our birthright.
Meaning you don't actually know?
I can only guess, as I count myself fortunate to live amongst its bones.
Ashok walked toward the edge to look down into the valley, but then he had to reassess his terms. It seemed more of a crater, like the graveyard of demons, though this was far larger, and there was no sign of what spectacular impact must have dug the massive thing. Far below was a white lake, and from the steam rising off the surface, it was a hot one. The sides of the crater might have once been smooth, but terraces had been cut into it all the way down. Upon many of those, crops were growing. Upon others, fences had been erected along the edges, and animals grazed inside. They were all connected by a wide road that wrapped like a corkscrew down the interior. Ashok realized the stone wall with the metal gate he had first seen was a dam, because a multitude of concrete pipes stretched from it down to feed the terraces.
I thought you were prone to exaggeration, Keeper. I was not expecting something so...
impressive. I told you it was wonderful. The one thing we have been missing is the voice of the gods, and now you have brought her back to us. I had faith that the Forgotten picked you for a reason.
Ashok wanted to argue against that superstitious foolishness, but there were more pressing matters at hand.
Thera also picked up a few hundred followers along the way.
A glimmer of some other emotion crossed Keita's face. Fear? Worry? But whatever it was, he quickly shoved it aside and put his happy face back on.
We saw the great mob camped below, but don't worry, as you can see, we have plenty of room. We will find shelter for all. Everything will be fine now.
We have spent far too much time traveling together for you to deceive me, Keita. What troubles you?
Nothing insurmountable, Ashok. The gods brought our prophet back. I'm sure they'll provide a way through our current difficulties as well.
Keita had been thin since they'd first met, but he was nearly emaciated now. There were dark circles beneath the Keeper's bloodshot eyes. Before him was a man who had been pushed to his ragged edge. Then Ashok looked over at the rebel guards, and he noted that all of them appeared pale and weary as well. One of them atop the dam coughed, and it was a wet, painful hacking sound.
There is a sickness here, Ashok said.
An illness has come upon us, yes, but the Forgotten was merely testing our mettle. I'm sure, now that the Prophet has returned, everything will get better.
The words were hesitant, as if Keita did not wish to speak freely in front of his men. Ashok was obligated to keep Thera safe. Exposing her to some plague was the opposite. As he took Keita by the arm and roughly steered him away, he whispered,
"Be forthright, Keeper. Lives are at stake. How dire is your situation here?"
Keita was stricken. "It starts as a weakness, a trembling in the extremities, and fits of coughing. Some of us develop sores on the body, armpits, thighs, and a few start bleeding from their nose, ears, and finally eyes. But all who've gotten to that stage died shortly after. The rest get a little better, but remain weak. We've lost nearly a tenth of our number this winter. Of the rest, half of us are still ill. These men here are the strongest I have left, and it's taken everything in my power to keep them from running away.
It is good you did. They only would have spread it across Akoshan.
Though he himself was immune to all diseases, Ashok had witnessed a sickness with those exact same symptoms ripped through a community before, though he had never heard of it appearing this far south.
It is the Gujaran blood eye.
Is there a cure?
No. It will only get worse. Keita did indeed have a great amount of land here, but it would only be useful for burying their dead.
Chapter 23. Spring was a good season for travel, so Jagdish and his wagon full of illegal demon parts had made excellent time. The trade roads were well maintained from Gunda to Arun, and even better, on to Vadal City. The Karsawan were so orderly that he didn't get accosted by a single bandit in their lands. Of course, a few fools had tried to rob him after he'd crossed into Sarnabat. That place was known as the Land of the Wolf for a few reasons, rampant banditry among them. Most of workers who needed to cross the northeasternmost house joined forces, formed caravans, and those who could afford to do so hired warriors to ride with them. When some criminals had seen Jagdish's wagon pass through all by itself, they took him to be an easy victim. He'd only had to cut one down before the rest of the cowards had fled. Those bandits must have spread the word to their peers that he was not worth the trouble, because he'd had no issues since. If they'd only known what was in his wagon, every wolf in this law-forsaken house would have come for him. The hardest part of his long journey was pretending to be a merchant. Dressing like a member of the worker caste wounded his warrior pride, but it was the only way he could smuggle hundreds of pounds of magic through other great houses. If any of the warriors he met along the way came to suspect what was really hidden beneath the rolls of cloth in his wagon, they'd kill him, seize his precious cargo, and then hold a feast in his honour because he'd just delivered them more riches than they could loot in 100 border raids. When Jagdish stopped at various inns along the way, he constantly had to remind himself not to be who he really was. Workers talked differently, they even stood different. If they possessed any pride, they'd best only show it around their betters. And they for damned sure didn't maintain direct eye contact and make a smart remark while being grilled by a Sarnabat border guard while getting his travelling papers stamped. That mistake had nearly earned him a duel before he'd managed to apologise his way out of his inadvertent offence. Of course, he should have known offence would be taken. Workers who were licensed to carry swords for self-defence, and he'd been sure to get Gutch to forge one of those papers for him, were looked upon with sneering disdain as uppity amateurs by the superior warrior caste. Only in this instance, that guard would have been in for quite the painful surprise if he'd not accepted Jagdish's apology. Yet, Jagdish had come to marvel just how much leeway workers got to generally travel about unimpeded. Warriors were only supposed to cross borders when they were ordered to, but workers, as long as they had the paper for it, and Gutch's forgeries were excellent, could go where they wanted. Conducting business, they called it. Well, some workers at least. The unlucky ones ended up obligated to spending their whole lives working in the same mine shaft or ploughing the same field. They were just as much victims to rank and status as his own caste in that respect. He had discovered that playing pretend was a great deal harder than it looked, but the stakes were high, so he made do. There was already a lot of shame heaped upon his name. According to accepted narrative, he'd failed to protect Great House Vadal from the Black Heart twice.
If he got caught with all this demon, he would end up giving an incredible amount of magical power to one of their rivals. It would be a long time before anyone in Vidal named their child Jagdish again. So he kept his head down and spoke to as few people as possible. It was lonely upon the trade road, and he missed the loud and boisterous companionship of Gutch. Though Gutch had tried his best to nag Jagdish from this honourable path, the Rizzledar was a hard man to sway. So while Jagdish had continued on toward their homeland, Gutch had remained in the city of Guntur. They'd divided their treasure, 50-50. Gutch hadn't even tried to rip him off by weight, which was a remarkable testament to their friendship, considering Gutch's general inclination toward thievery. Before they had parted, the smuggler had educated him on which checkpoints to avoid and who to bribe if necessary. Magic smugglers often left marks or graffiti in a secret code around border checkpoints, so their fellows would know who was willing to take a bribe or which official to avoid because they were thorough in their searches. These lessons had been greatly appreciated. It wasn't as though honourable warriors like Jagdish had much experience in such things. It had been with great solemnity that Gutch had said his goodbyes. It was plain on the big man's face that he believed Jagdish was delivering himself to his own execution. Come to think of it, that must have made it even harder for Gutch to resist the urge to try and steal Jagdish's share of the demon, since it was probably just going to get confiscated anyway. Bluster to the contrary, Gutch was a true friend. Sarnabat reminded him of a wilder, untamed version of Vidal. Less populated, too, but that was mostly because he'd taken a route designed to avoid most of the major towns. During the warm days, he'd drive his team of oxen, and by the cool nights, he'd lay in his wagon, dreaming of his reunion with Pakpa and their child he had never met. But his sleep was often fretful, as his dreams turned to unease and dark thoughts about how his return would be received. For though Jagdish had accomplished great things, he'd done so in the company of their house's most infamous criminal. And then, one glorious morning, Jagdish found himself approaching the border of Great House Vidal. When he saw the distant blue, grey, and bronze flag flapping in the breeze, an involuntary smile crossed his face. At long last, I am home. Tensions must have still been running high between Sarnabat and Vidal, because there was a full palton of warriors set up in a temporary camp here. Yet, there must not have been any recent raiding, because the men looked so bored they could barely trouble themselves enough to notice yet another worker's wagon. That simply would not do. Jagdish had been thinking about this moment for months. He could risk smuggling his illegal cargo across another border, and though he liked to think Vidal's soldiers would be more diligent in their duties than the other houses and catch him, he knew they probably wouldn't. He could continue pretending to be a merchant all the way to Vidal City and the Great House itself, but such a discreet entry would make it very easy for Heart of Vidal to simply make Jagdish disappear. However, if he made a grand entrance, a proper warrior entrance, then word would spread, and his whole caste would hear about the deeds of avenging Jagdish, bringer of treasure, killer of wizards and demons. It would be harder for a Thakur to execute a hero than just another dishonored scrub. Gutch had not needed to worry so much. Jagdish certainly wasn't a politician, but he was not stupid. A grand entrance it would be. Whoa! Jagdish pulled on the reins until his lumbering team of oxen came to a stop, still a few hundred yards from the checkpoint. Once the four obedient animals were content, Jagdish climbed back into his wagon and pulled out the fabric he had purchased in Guntur. The dyes lacked the depth and vibrancy of true Vidal colours, but it was as close as he was going to find in a lesser house. His real uniform had been lost in Niramphon, but this would have to do. After tearing off the worker's insignia, that felt good, Jagdish tied his improvised Vidal colours around his chest as a sash. His obvious delay, stopped in the middle of the trade road, had made the soldiers curious, and a few more had approached the checkpoint to see what this odd merchant was up to. When you were stationed in the field, any activity out of the ordinary was interesting. By the time Jagdish got back on the bench, there was a small crowd waiting.
Excellent.
He put the sack of treasure he'd picked out special on the seat next to him and flicked the reins.
Go!
The oxen complied, pulled, and the wagon began to roll. Toward legend or infamy, Jagdish did not yet know. The soldiers shared an incredulous look as he drew near.
What's with the sash, merchant? You're trying to play dress-up?
Perhaps he wants to look like he belongs to a real caste, said another.
Surely this fool knows it takes more than wearing our colours to be a warrior of Great House Vidal.
Whoa!
Jagdish got his oxen to halt. These soldiers plainly thought he was just some merchant mocking them, and thus about to catch an educational beating. But it felt so good to cross the border he couldn't help but grin.
Hello, warriors of Great House Vidal. You have no idea how happy I am to see you.
The highest-ranking man there was only a senior Nayak, but he must have been the one actually manning his duty station, because he held up one hand to silence his friends, and then loudly and officially declared,
"Prepare your papers, merchant."
"I have no papers for you, Nayak, but I bring more treasure to this house than this checkpoint will collect in taxes in a million years."
Then Jagdish leapt down from the wagon, got on his knees, and kissed the ground. That was the dirt of his homeland. It was theatrical and silly, but he enjoyed doing it. Then he laughed, raised his hands to the sky, and announced,
"I am home, brothers!"
"Good for you, but you're not my brother," muttered the senior. "Now hurry it up, worker."
"I am no worker." Jagdish stood. "Fetch your commanding officer, Nayak. He will want to hear this."
Now the soldiers were really curious. A couple of them chuckled.
"I think this merchant's been in the sun too long."
But someone did go to get their leader. Anything shiny enough to catch the attention of a few warriors would eventually gather a crowd. That was just the way of things in camp. More men ambled over, probably thinking the merchant was about to try and sell them something. But Jagdish waited until an officer approached. The Rizaldar's uniform appeared squared away, and like all proper professional soldiers, he seemed annoyed that someone was wasting his time with nonsense.
"What's all this?"
"This worker claims he's not a worker, sir."
"What is he then?"
Jagdish suddenly used his command voice, so all the camp would hear.
"I am Rizaldar Jagdish, warrior of Great House Vidal, formerly of the Personal Guard, and last commander of the Coldstream Garrison."
From the confused looks, apparently none of them had ever heard of him. But they were way out on the eastern border, so that was no surprise. It was a long way to Vidal City.
"Coldstream is one of the places that got massacred by the Black Heart," said the Rizaldar suspiciously. "It was, but that crime was not carried out by Ashok Vidal, but rather by a gang of evil, shape-shifting wizards. I spent the last year chasing down the real killers across half of Lok. I return now, having exacted revenge for this insult against our caste."
When Jagdish reached for the sack, several hands moved to their swords, but the Rizaldar waved for them to calm down. He wanted to see where this show was going. Jagdish took out a golden symbol hanging from a chain.
"This is a trophy from Lost House Charsada."
"Who?"
"A powerful gang of magical assassins, the lot of them. It was they who spilled Vidal blood at Coldstream and Sutpo Bridge. They lived in a secret fortress far away between the Nansaka and the sea. But they are broken now, dead or scattered, and their house reduced to rubble. I saw to that."
Well, he'd had a lot of help, but Jagdish didn't want to get into the details quite yet. One of the junior Naiacs snorted. A likely story.
Oh, but I didn't just kill illegal wizards, my friend. There were many other battles along the way.
Jagdish reached back into the sack.
I don't care what your tall tale is, worker or warrior. If you want to cross this border, you're going to show me some tax papers or...
Jagdish held up a skull, big as a melon, with a splintered hole in the top. With the razor-sharp teeth and no eye sockets, it was plain what it was, and still terrifying, even stripped of flesh. The soldiers were shocked into silence when they beheld the demon skull. Jagdish simply dropped the precious item in the dirt, an act so nonchalant that it seemed to surprise them even more. It rolled over to bump against the boot of the Rizaldar, who instinctively flinched away.
Impossible, said one of the soldiers.
He must have found that on a beach somewhere. No, I beat that head in with a mace myself. As I said,
Jagdish reached into the sack again.
I saw a great many battles.
He held aloft the second skull, this one half smashed by a blow from Ashok's warhammer. The soldiers gasped.
Oceans!
He dropped that one too.
And then they stared at him in awe as he reached into the sack once again, unbelieving, as Jagdish produced a third demon skull. This one had belonged to the one they'd squished beneath the statue of the smiling fat man.
A great, great many battles.
The warriors were just staring at him, or staring at the skulls. Each one of those was worth more banknotes than they'd be paid in their whole lives.
And now I'm on my way back to Vidal City with these and the rest of my cargo.
The Rizaldar looked up from the skull by his foot, mouth agape.
There's more.
Jagdish walked to the back of his wagon. The entire crowd followed him. He unlatched the tailgate, let it fall open, and then threw aside the concealing cloth. The bottom of the wagon was full of demon bones.
There'd be more, but we killed these in rough country with no real roads, and I only had access to so many donkeys to pack them out. We killed an even bigger one, too, though we had to drop an entire mansion on him to do it. Couldn't carry that fellow out, though. The bones simply weighed too much.
Oceans!
The Rizaldar practically staggered to the wagon, and then had to hold onto the wood to keep from falling over. Then he realized where they were and looked fearfully back over his shoulder.
We're right on the border! If Sarnabat knew about this treasure, they'd send their entire army after it. Naiac, send for the other Paltons. Tell them we need to be reinforced now. Move! Now, damn it, now!
As one of the men sprinted to get help, Jagdish laughed.
I crossed all of Sarnabat with this by myself. But on that note, I could use an exit back to Vidal City so that I can deliver this to the Great House personally. Of course, Rizaldar Jagdish. Anything you need.
Jagdish looked down at his flimsy sash.
A proper uniform would be nice, if you got one to spare.
The soldiers were staring at Jagdish now, like Keeta's fanatics looked at Thera. Word of this would spread to every barracks and every drinking hall, and, knowing soldiers, by next week it would have been 20 demon skulls instead of 3, and Jagdish would have sword-fought half of Sarnabat to get here. This was how legends were born. Chapter 24. Word had spread even more quickly than Jagdish had expected. By the time they got to his home province, there was a small army guarding his one-wagon caravan. Of course, they weren't his to command. Not even close. In fact, it was obvious the officers didn't know what to do with him. He was outside of their command structure. On one hand, they'd surely gotten word that he'd last been seen riding with a terrible criminal. But on the other hand, he had brought them a fortune worth of magic. So they were polite, guarded his demon wagon, and waited for word to come down from their superiors as to what to do with him. However, each night they made camp, more soldiers had approached Jagdish to hear tales of his adventures. And Jagdish had been happy to tell them. Not just because all Vidal warriors loved to spin a tale, but also because Jagdish knew his best chance for survival was for it to become too politically unpopular for Harta to kill him. Nobody liked executing heroes. So Jagdish had talked and talked. Only he'd started at the beginning, at that fateful party where he had been among the men who had dueled Ashok Vidal, and he told nothing but the truth. Always with the truth, because an honorable man had no use for liars, and besides, other Vidal warriors had been there. Despite the First Caste's official version of events, and apparently the capital had even made a play out of it, performances of which had been banned in Vidal, Jagdish figured the basic truth would have filtered down to the rank and file by now. Yes, Ashok had secretly been born a non-person. But he was still the greatest combatant possibly in the entire history of the world, so there should be no dishonor in losing to such a foe. It had been mighty Angruvadal that had killed the Thakor he had been sworn to protect, not Ashok. Bedeya had committed suicide as far as he was concerned. That was the risk one took when they tried to pick up an ancestor blade. That might not be a popular opinion with the First Caste, but it was what it was, and the warriors all knew it. Jagdish told them of how, as warden, he'd sparred against the Black Heart daily, even though his listeners thought him either mad or fearless or both to do so. He had to hold back tears as he talked about the slaughter of his men at Coldstream, and then control his anger over how he'd been treated by their command afterward. Then he spoke of finding out that one of his prisoners was a tracker of magic, and his decision to free Gutch in order to pursue the Black Heart. Truth and honor were wonderful things, but Jagdish liked to leave the next part a little fuzzy in the telling, so he'd kind of skipped over the bits where he'd taught a gang of religious fanatic rebels how to be better soldiers. Besides, what his audience really wanted to hear about was fighting wizards and demons. Regardless, Jagdish was honest about the involvement of Ashok Vidal. Hated now though he may be, Ashok had still managed to kill a squad of demons mostly by himself, and done it without the aid of mighty Angruvadal.
"Oh, you've not heard. Angruvadal is gone, my friends."
Then he'd had to break that terrible news to his people, because they'd not known of the destruction of their ancestor blade. Most of them had been hoping that somehow their sword would return to them again someday. That part was always heartbreaking. Jagdish's story had it all. Heroism, adventure, tragedy, and triumph. After several days of this, he'd become very good at telling his story. There was a rhythm to it, catching the audience and bringing them along through the ups and downs. He was starting to understand why Keita had enjoyed preaching so much. Whenever they crossed into another garrison's territory, some of his guard would drop off to return home, but those were immediately replaced by others. Surely some ambitious Fonto or local wizards must have contemplated trying to seize Jagdish's treasure for themselves, but since riders had already gone ahead to alert their Thakur, such greedy ambitions would only end badly for them. So instead, each province had contributed more soldiers to accompany Jagdish's caravan to demonstrate their devotion instead. Which meant that each night Jagdish had a new audience. Some of them believed him. Some did not. But ultimately, only one man's opinion would really matter. Sadly, it appeared Harta Vidal did not care about legends. When they were one day out of Vidal City, several members of the personal guard joined them on the road. Since the personal guard answered only to the Thakur, all of the provincial garrisons were obligated to obey their commands, and those commands were exceedingly clear. They took command of the column. Jagdish was unceremoniously taken into custody. They confiscated his sword, which was a bad sign. but they did not tie his hands, which was a good sign. Some of them stayed with the wagon, but the rest would escort Jagdish. He was put upon a fast horse, and they rode for the city. Even though the personal guard was his old unit, he was acquainted with none of the men he was riding with. Jagdish tried not to show how nervous he was as he asked them questions. Were they going to the great house? What did Harte intend to do with him? Yet they were uncommunicative and refused to answer. The lack of response and his lack of a sword was making him very worried.
If I'm to be executed, can we at least stop and see my wife and child first, so that I may say goodbye? She's been staying with her family while I've been away. It's not very far off our path. I've not seen them for a long time. I'd like to at least hold my son once before I die. Give me at least that. Half a ton of demon has got to at least be worth that small mercy.
The personal guard were all seasoned warriors. Most of them had been assigned wives and had children of their own, who they often went for months without seeing because of their duties. He could tell his request struck their hearts, but orders were orders, so they'd not stopped riding. Only they rode past the fork that would take them to the great house and an audience with the Thakor himself. Jagdish knew the city well, so he quickly figured out where they were heading instead, and a cold lump of dread had formed in his stomach. They went to Coldstream Prison. They rode past the spot where he and Gutch had defeated the wizard Loam, and through the gates where Jagdish had single-handedly tried to hold back a prison break. Inside, the damage had been repaired, the blood-stained walls painted over. New warriors had been obligated to serve as guards. They did not know him. It felt odd to be in a place so familiar, but in such a painfully different position.
"I take it you've not brought me here to give me my old job back?" Jagdish asked, already knowing the answer.
The ranking member of the personal guard was a warrior named Girish.
"I'm afraid not."
"Execution, then?"
"Not yet. Holding for now."
"I truly am sorry." Jagdish nodded.
"It's fine. Fate's a stone-hearted bitch, though, isn't she?"
"Indeed she is, Rizaldar. Indeed she is," Girish said, with resignation rather than cruelty. Jagdish knew the process well, having overseen it many times. He'd be stripped and searched for processing next.
"One last request, Girish, from a former member of the personal guard to one current."
He reached into his recently acquired uniform and pulled out his most prized possession in the world, the pocket watch he'd won in a bet in this very courtyard.
"Would you say this gets to my wife? I'd like my son to have it."
"I will do so. You have my word." As Jagdish was locked in a tiny, dark cell in the prison he'd once been the warden of, all he could do was laugh and say,
"Well, this is ironic."
Chapter 25. Thera felt as if she was floundering in the ocean again, being bashed against rocks by forces beyond her control. She despised the feeling. Ashok had intercepted her in the tunnel to warn her about the plague that was destroying the cove. Keita and the people inside didn't realize just how dire their situation was,